are doing something. We're working on something for We Talk Comics, and of course, our partnership with Comicosity is like the best, and we want to thank our sponsor there. Best comic book website on planet Earth. And we're working on something that's – we're not going to reveal too many details, but it's the biggest thing we ever worked on. We think it's something that's needed and will be good for the industry. And it's a big, big project. And in doing so, we were kind of what we were doing was we were kind of going through and looking at the history of the industry and the diversity of the creators. And in doing so, and that's kind of – I'll go over to Brett now. And he's the one who actually discovered your website and then hooked up the interview. So, Brett, why don't you pick it up from there?
Well, I think what happened was we were putting out all these naming all these creators. And at some point, somebody challenged us to and said, hey, well, what happened to the diversity? You know, like all these guys are white. And so I got thinking about it, like, okay, well, that can't be right. You know, and so then I started going looking, and I was looking for all these names. And then as it stands, I came across your blog about diversity and the does anybody really care about diversity in comics. And so it was just one of those cases where that got me thinking about having you on and this idea that you might be able to help shed some light on this from our perspective.
Sure. I've caught a lot of flack over that piece, but also a lot of praise for it too. So yeah, I would be more than happy to delve into that subject matter with you.
Yeah, because, well, I guess the thing is, and I mean, I know we don't necessarily look at it. I mean, we don't necessarily read that many DC or Marvel books ourselves. Now, Jimmy Robinson, one of my favorite creators. I mean, we love Five Weapons, you know, absolutely amazing stuff. But, you know, what about history? Because one of the things that I came across was Jackie Orms.
Yeah.
Who did Torchy Brown. And so my thought was like, well, obviously she deserves to be named, because she seems to have an important place in history. But then there's this question of like, well, you know, we hadn't per se heard of her before. And so it was like, you know, it's those kind of people that we want to be able to bring out.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing too. There's these creators that have, in one regard or another, Jackie Orms is a perfect one. You know, she was an amazing creator with a great volume of work, great body of work, and nowadays she's not that well known or remembered. There was a cartoonist who just passed away, who did I'll have to look it up, but he just died earlier this year, who was a syndicated cartoonist, and you know, so it's not quite comic books, but you know,
for the purpose of what we're looking at, that's also among it. Anybody who's worked basically in any form of sequential art, we're looking at the history of. So,
you know, there's you know, when I was a kid growing up, and the big difference between now and then is that we have, you know, the internet, and so we know what a lot of creators look like. You know, when Wizard magazine started, publishing and putting pictures of creators in there, suddenly you got to see what everybody looked like. But before, I mean, the first black creator that I ever met was a guy named Ron Wilson.
And I know Ron Wilson. I didn't even know he was black. Of course, he did The Thing with John Byrne and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. He you know, drew tons of issues of like Marvel 2-in-1 with The Thing, a lot of stuff like that. And I just happened to meet him at a convention. I was probably about 12 years old and didn't know at the time that he was a black creator. And when I met him, it blew my mind. But it also, for me, was like, oh, wow. You know, like the only people I knew what they looked like was, you know, basically Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. That was about all you really knew. And suddenly this whole world of possibilities was presented to me. And in that era, you know, there was Ron Wilson, there was Keith Pollard, a little later on there was Paris Cullins, and I'm trying to think who else. There's a handful of other guys that, you know, once word got out, like people started talking about, like, oh yeah, these are the black creators. Dennis Cowan was, you know, this was in the he was in the '80s, in doing
Power Man and Iron Fist.
Yeah. Oh,
so awesome.
And there was a guy named, I believe his name was Steve.
I didn't
Mitchell.
Realize Paris Collins. I didn't realize he was African American.
Yeah.
Blue Devil.
Yeah, Blue Devil. Trevor Von Eden.
Yeah.
Another one.
Black Lightning. Yep.
Yeah, Black Lightning. And so there's a handful of guys. Billy Graham, I believe. And I could be wrong on this one. I think Billy Graham, who drew a lot of the Luke Cage Hero for Hire comics, I believe he was African American as well too. Though I could be wrong on that one, but I'm usually not wrong. So
I'm never wrong. Good, huh?
But you guys are Mary Poppins, man.
One of the things I'm noticing you're saying is, here's the artist. You're not saying, here's the writer, here's the editor.
Yeah, that's true. So in terms of writers, you know, I mean, the king of all the writers really is you know, the late, great Dwayne McDuffie. And he, you know, paved the way in you know, for a lot of people. I am, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm hard-pressed to come up with any writers.
Christopher James Priest.
Yes.
James,
Chris Priest.
Hudlin.
Yeah, Reggie Hudlin. And, you know, and there's definitely some guys that came along later into the 80s and into the 90s through Milestone. But before Dwayne, yeah, I'm having a tough time coming up
with... Do you know when Dwayne started working in the industry?
Yeah, he started in the, I want to say it was the early to mid 80s.
So that's about the same time as Priest started, actually.
Yeah. I could look him up here in a second. And there's another one who's, the person who just passed away was Maury Turner, by the way. Mm-hmm. And he had a syndicated strip called We Pals. And that was it was sort of an offshoot of Peanuts, and I believe that Charles Schulz had a hand in helping get his career going, but he died earlier this year, and he's thought of as one of the premier syndicated black cartoonists. There's been a couple others too, to be sure, but. But Maury Turner is sort of the guy. And I'm looking to see.
I'm just wondering, how familiar are you with the work of Jackie Orms? Because, you know, until Brett brought her name up to me, I don't know her at all. And of course, we were looking at different people that deserve to be highlighted. And Brett was like, well, first female black writer, artist, creator. And I said, yeah, but is that enough if the work isn't good? And how can I even necessarily judge how good this work is after this many years? So how familiar are you with her?
I'm not like a Jackie Orms historian per se, but there was there's actually a book out about her, and it gets into a lot of her work, and there's a lot of examples of it. The book is fairly new, fairly recent. But she, you know, if you look at that era that she was part of, and, you know, she was, she was active in the 40s and 50s primarily. She's a pretty good force to be reckoned with in terms of her talent. Her artistic abilities, that sort of thing, they're good enough that you would think more people would know that historically she'd be remembered more. She's not up there necessarily with like Hal Foster, or Alex Raymond in terms of art, but she's not that far behind either. She definitely is capable of holding her own. And I've never actually read any of her stuff. I've seen a ton of it, but, I've never actually read any of it, so I don't know how the reading holds up. But the art is more than is actually really good, I think.
From what I've seen, and like I say, it probably should be more. But Torchy Brown, she looks like Jackie Orms, so I wonder how much of these stories were semi autobiographical or as I pronounce a word about as well as Chris would.
Autobiographical?
Thank you. You know, but yeah, I mean, you see it just seemed like early part of the days, forget it, like you say, I mean, the idea that we're looking at the, you know, early to mid 80s before writers or who knows when editors, because I mean, Priest did have a short run as an editor, but he wasn't, you know, terribly successful at it, I suppose, but at the time, but you know, I mean, the idea that we're looking at the 80s, I mean, that's honestly scary.
That's a very big gap there, yeah.
That's unbelievable.
I think that Dwayne McDuffie, as I'm looking, it looks like he didn't really get started until like 1990 or so.
So Priest would have been the first, arguably.
Yeah. Christopher Priest probably would have been. And you know, I'll probably get a ton of flack after this. There's probably someone else, some other people that I'm forgetting, and there was definitely some people in the indie world out there that was doing stuff. But in terms of mainstream comics writers, I'm going to have to do some homework now.
We're going to have to have you back on. To have you back on. And you know what the thing is? I mean, I know as far as artists, I mean, the earliest one I know of was Matt Baker. He drew Phantom Lady. But you know, I know very few others back in the Golden Age.
Yeah, and the fact that we're struggling to come up with names like this is indicative of either of the lack of creators who are working, but it's also just reflective of, you know, sort of, I guess you could say that the poor recording of history, which also, you know, can become problematic after a time. You know, we forget who people were or what they did. And and that in and of itself can be difficult.
You know, I mean, again, we're in Canada and it is a little bit different here. I mean, I think it's about 12% of the states, 12-13% of the states is African American. Does that sound about right?
That sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, we're technically, I think, according to the census, we're looking at about 3% of Canada. But quite honestly, you're not just the first black person I've talked to today. You're the first black person I've actually seen today. You know, and that's true. Like, it's so. But nevertheless,
there are parts of the United States where the exact same thing can be said. So it's not that odd. If you were calling me from, like, say, Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia, or something, I'd be concerned. but you guys have, I'm not sure where in Canada he's from, but yeah, Ken Lashley is like one of the hottest artists in the industry, and he's, I guess, what you African Canadian, is that it? Is that the?
I think that's the way it's listed in that supposed political correct world,
But nevertheless, I mean, if we're looking at 12% of the population, we don't see 12% of the creators in the industry. We don't see 12% of the characters, even now, historically.
And I can take that one step further, because I go to San Diego Comic Con every year. Last year I went to the New York Comic Con for the first time. I go to WonderCon. I go to some of the bigger shows here in the States. And you know, at San Diego, if you were to remove the people of color, by people of color I mean black folks, Latinos, Asians, and women from that audience, they get about 120 to 130,000 people there. If you were to remove them from the audience and just have it white males, more than half the audience would be gone. I mean, San Diego Comic-Con and New York especially, the when you look around and you see the number of fans, the number of readers who, again, are people of color or women, and then you see the lack of representation that's both in the content, but then also on the creative side, that's when it starts getting really disheartening. And you go, okay, wait a sec, now there's a huge problem here. I mean, right now, Marvel only has one black writer working there. That's Philippe Smith, I believe, the guy who's writing Ghost Rider. Mm-hmm. Dexter Vines, who's an inker, is doing work for them because he inks everything that Ed McGuinness draws, but you know, DC doesn't have a single black writer. And I don't know, in terms of artists, I don't know if anyone's working over there or not. I don't think Sanford Green's doing anything for them right now. So again, it's like, yeah, that those numbers are really low in the industry, but at Marvel and DC, which again are owned by Warner Brothers and or Disney and Warner Brothers respectively, like it's atrocious. I'll go on record of saying this. I think that there needs to be a class action lawsuit filed against both Disney and Warner Brothers for discrimination, because there's absolutely no way that they can have that many people working for them but have so few women and so-called minorities, when like I have the names and phone numbers in my cell phone programmed of people who are good enough to be working for either of those companies.
So then I have a question, because there was a big backlash when Gail Simone was dropped off of Batgirl and then she was put back on. Now there's all this always talk about women writing female characters. And so I'm wondering, when do you have the same kind of element when you think about white people writing black characters versus black people writing black characters?
Me personally, I'm not as militant as some people are. I think if a writer is a good writer, then I'm happy with it. You know, we can go back to Greg Rucka. Greg Rucka writes great female characters, and I can think of no reason why he should be stopped from doing that, or why anyone would say, oh, you can't do that. You know, I think that, you know, Gail Simone, if she wants to write, whether it's Batwoman or Red Sonja, that's fine. But if she wants to write other characters, there, no one should be stopping her from doing that. You know, I love, you know, Ultimate Spider-Man is my favorite Marvel book right now. I love Miles Morales. I love Miles Morales far more than I ever thought I would love Peter Parker, but I do. And honestly, I don't want to see anyone other than me, I don't want to see anyone writing that character, you know, other than Bendis, that is. You know, there's someone writing him in one of the other, the new Ultimates or something. And I'm just like, okay, yeah. I haven't been won over by that writer yet. But if a writer is a good writer, let him do it, you know, let her do it. Let them explore, you know, different characters and just tell really good stories. I don't, you know, if Marvel called me up tomorrow and said, you know, hey, we want you to do something, what characters do you want to work with? You know, my first choice wouldn't be Luke Cage or Black Panther for sure. You know, same with DC. I would write Black Lightning if they asked me, but that's not who I'd really want to work with if I had my choice.
Well, I mean, Gail Simone, there's backlash when she's taken off Batgirl and then she's put back on, but it almost does seem like, hey, we have a female character. We have Red Sonja. We need a female writer then. Get Gail Simone. Yeah. You know, we need a Batgirl. We need a female writer. Oh, Gail Simone. We have Captain Marvel. We need a female character. Gail Simone's not ready. Give her to Kelly Sue DeConnick. And to get pigeonholed in that, oh, these are the ones you have to give to these. They're females and these are female characters. You have to give it to them. And it's I mean, the same thing. I mean, I know, someone like the Army of Dr. Moreau, you're not just, you know, writing a character of color. And same thing. I mean, you see Jimmy Robinson's and Five Weapons is a very diverse universe that he's managed to create. And you know, Kyle Baker's one of my all-time favorites. He's managed to avoid that. But it seems, for instance, Christopher Priest did at points have to fight against being pigeonholed. I mean, not just Power Man, but, you know, I mean, he was given like Captain America and the Falcon and
Black Panther.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, I mean, is there that issue as well?
Yeah, it is. But that's, I think that's narrow-minded thinking on the parts of editors more than anything else. It's like, you know, I mean, I think it's interesting that, you know, and again, he takes flack for this one too, but I think that Luke Cage did not become an interesting character, a really truly interesting character, until Brian Bendis put him in New Avengers, or put him in Alias, I should say.
You're killing me here. Yeah.
You know? and
I'm such a fan.
And I love Luke Cage, you know. I have every issue of Luke Cage and every issue of, you know, Power Man and Iron Fist, and I love that character. But, like, he went through such a transformation when Brian started writing him.
If you go back and read James Owsley, then his James Owsley, now he's Christopher Priest.
Yeah.
Run at the end. I think that's where the character started to get fleshed out. And then he killed Iron Fist and wasn't seen for 7-8 years.
Yeah. No, exactly. And there was some stuff they did with him in the 90s that just didn't really work. Oh. And but yeah, you know, it's. I mean, I had put together a Falcon pitch last year that never went anywhere at Marvel. And I was like, you know,
actually I was going to bring that up to you because one of your blogs on Badass Movo, I think you said something along the lines of you'd love it if you got a chance to write the Falcon, but you'd never be allowed to write the character that you want to write anyways.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't, because the thing is, we think about this, the character has been around for like 44 years, something like that. And there is the closest thing to a definitive Falcon story there is people go, oh, well, that miniseries that they did in the 80s that Christopher Priest, when his name was Owsley, wrote it, and Paul Smith drew one or two issues, and it is not a memorable story. You know,
you also pointed that out when you talk about sidekicks. I mean, you really blew my mind because I never even realized it. You're right. None of these characters are presented as equals. It's amazing.
Exactly. And so, you know, my vision of Falcon would be, why not like, I love what they were doing with Ultimate Falcon at one point, but I was like, you know, this guy could actually be the ultimate badass of the Marvel Universe, or at the very least he could, you know, you could do like a book like Hawkeye, like what Matt Fraction's done with Hawkeye. Not to say that style, because Matt's got a lock on that, but just really reinvent the character and make him interesting. But really, all he spent 40 something years as a sidekick. I mean, there are other sidekicks. You know, Bucky became Winter Soldier. Robin became Nightwing. There's so many other sidekicks that have graduated past that. And again, the fact that you can have a character who's been around for 40 something years and yet still does not have a definitive story. You know, the most definitive part of the story is that the Red Skull actually created him and brainwashed him as a long-term, like, Manchurian candidate to kill Captain America, which was like, I think it was a Steve Englehart story from the 70s that when you read it, you're like, you read it then and you were like, this is stupid. You read it now and you're like, oh my God, this is even more stupid.
Yeah, I just recently read the Kirby Captain America Falcon issues, and yeah, I mean, it's very distinct in his sidekickedness.
And you know what, I know what you're saying about Luke Cage. I do get what you're saying about Luke Cage, though I love the character and I always have, but I mean, there's no doubt, even I am sitting there as a you know, kid, a 12-year-old kid or whatever, and I'm reading my Power Man and I'm seeing a character that, even though I'm not familiar at the point with black exploitation movies, I'm seeing a character that's obviously tied into that, and I'm seeing the dialogue written by, it appears, a white guy who saw two black exploitation movies and think this is now how the characters talk. And it was wrong to me.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? No, I agree. And, you know, try growing up that way, you know, being aware of that from about the time you're 7 or 8 years old, and then suddenly you're, you know, you're in your 40s and you're like, okay, nothing's changed that much. I guess I'm going to have to start making a big stink, which is, you know, part of what I'm...
Nothing has changed. It's really amazing to me. I mean, until we started kind of looking into this here, it's like, wow, the changes aren't nearly... I mean, like Clayton Henry, to me, was my pick for best artist of the year last year. Worked over at Valiant, and I think he's brilliant.
Yeah.
And, you know, nobody knows him.
Yeah. Well, and that's, if you're not doing something at Marvel or DC, you run in the risk that only a handful of people know you.
Yeah.
And that's just the reality.
He is black, but that's not the point. The point is nobody knows him, but nobody knows him and he's black. You should know both things. You know what I mean? Yeah. You should know that he's great by himself. That's enough to talk about. And he's great and he's like that. He's, you know, like you say, you talk about the different, I mean, there are more out there than people realize, more creators of color than people realize that, but there's no place for anybody to, I don't know. Nobody talked about it. So like you say, yeah. I mean, if you're not working at the big two, you don't exist. And that sucks.
Yeah.
Well, and also, is there something attached to it that's kind of a problematic? Because I you know, it's like us as you know, white guys from Canada. Is it hard for us to just? Does it feel like we're
and singling, obviously look at us? We're three of the whitest guys from Canada you'll ever meet.
That's very true. But does it feel like we're just signaling or singling people out? You know, and saying like, "Hey, he's black." Yeah. And I don't necessarily, you know, I don't think we want to do that.
Why
per is se, that?
Why but... are we even talking about this?
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Not to offend anybody, but like, why is this interesting to us and seem to be an issue for us as three white guys from Canada? Then you know.
Well, I think that if it's an issue for you, that's it's what it comes down to is that there's this moment in everybody's life where like. It's like in the Matrix, you know, when he wakes up and it's like, well, do you take the red pill or do you take the blue pill? Which route do you go down? And it's like, you know, I have this, I was doing this thing on my website for a while and I just sort of backed off of it cause I just haven't had the time, but where I was doing a list of great movies, you know, beloved movies that have no black people in them, yeah. You know, like, and it was movies like, you know, the first three Lord of the Rings, there's not, you know, people go, well, there's like someone in makeup, an orc in makeup does not count as a person of color. There's nothing but white people in the first three Lord of the Rings movies. The first black person makes their appearance.
Well, it's not, none in the book.
Yeah, right? Exactly. But that's the book and the movie is the book, movie, yeah. You know, and so what drives me bonkers is like, you can, there's so many movies when you look at them, and some are great movies. I mean, I love The Princess Bride. It's a great movie, but there's not a single person of color in The Princess Bride. And there's no reason why there couldn't have been one, you know, there's all kinds of parts that could have been played, even small bit parts, character actors in the background. And once you point stuff like that out to people, then they start going, oh, okay, wait a sec. Okay. Why is that? And it's the same. It's along the same lines with what we're talking about now, where it's like, you know, it's we don't have to point out that there's creators of color, except for the fact that, you know, we're still fighting this battle of trying to get more fair representation within the comics.
I'm gonna bring up two questions for you, and I'm sorry if you want to continue your point, but. Do you want to continue your point?
No, go on.
Okay, well then, two things I just get you to comment on, and I know at least you've written a blog on at least one of these things that I've seen. But Michael B. Jordan cast as Johnny Storm, the Human Torch, and the backlash to that. Go.
Yeah. Oh, I think the backlash is absolutely ridiculous.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, I think we should be more concerned about the guy they cast as Thing, as Ben Grimm, than we should be the guy they cast as Human Torch. That's me personally. And I'm just more concerned that, you know, between the two movies that were made and then that one that Roger Corman produced, there hasn't been a good Fantastic Four movie yet. If Fantastic Four sucks, if the new movie is terrible, it's not going to be because a black guy is playing Johnny Storm.
And you know what? If he was a shitty actor, it'd be completely different. I'd be bitching about that. I'm bitching about Ben Affleck as Batman. But yeah. You know what? I'm not complaining about Michael B. Jordan because I've seen him on Friday Night Lights and I know what a good actor he is. It blew my mind. How about what happens with Wally West? What are your thoughts there?
You know, I am so not the whole Wally West thing. I have not paid any attention to it at all. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because it's DC and I've been ignoring DC a lot since the New 52.
Me too.
So I honestly I could not weigh in on that and sound even remotely into it's not even stupid.
I'll say this. The writer, Robert Venditti, is a great writer, and his are the titles from DC I read. So I'll recommend it that way. But, yeah. You know, but there's a lot of backlash. I mean, what is the big deal? Who cares of what color he is? I mean, don't we need more characters of color? Why are people flipping out going, no, that's not who Wally West is. Why not?
Yeah, and that's sort of my attitude. I mean, it's like, you know, it's all, you know, and people will then come back, well, how would you feel if Luke Cage was, you know, they turned him white all of a sudden. And what I try to explain is, well, the difference is that Marvel only has four black characters. You know? So if you get rid of, I'm actually working on an article right now.
Here's the thing that I want to say, you know, and I'll put it this way, and I know I'm cutting you off again, but it's okay. Just Alan Scott gets turned gay, and people cheer. Wally West gets turned black, and people flip out.
Yeah.
Fuck you guys.
Well, because I mean, and I don't have a problem with any of these things, but the thing is that right now gay seems to be the predominant, you know, it thing. It's the in thing, and so it's like people are working
all a minority.
Yeah, people are working so hard to you know, approve of that I think we're forgetting that there's so many more things that need to be opened up and approved of as well.
Everything should be approved.
Yeah, everything. Well, except neo-Nazism, but let's not go
okay,
too far.
Please, go ahead. I won't cut you off anymore.
No, and I think that it's all very interesting. I mean, it's, and again, I don't know, I haven't been reading, you know, Flash or any of the New 52 really, so I can't really weigh in on the Wally West thing without, you know, reading some of the comics my own self. You know, you know, there were people who had a lot of complaints of Miles
Morales. You have an assignment then for next week when you come back.
Okay, I will run to the comic store and check them out.
They're actually really good. I like them a lot. I've been not too big into DC, but I love the
again,
Flash.
We had Robert on, and you know, he said, "Okay, this came down as a directive from editorial," and he's like, "And I don't care. I'm just going to write a good character. I'm going to write an interesting character, and what else matters?"
Yeah, and I think that you know, people, comic fans especially, have these odd attachments to their characters that they
and
love.
Break our toys.
And I don't. It's sad and scary to me. You know, like I always joke around. It's like, well, see, like I've actually been in a relationship and had sex and things like that. So I know that there's more to life than just comics.
You're my favorite guest ever. I think I said that last week of Matt Hawkins, and I think you might have just topped that line.
But yeah, I think that comics fans need to lighten up, and the sad part is when some of them don't realize how horrifically racist and sexist they are, and it's like one thing, you know, there's this this trend I've seen as this sort of geek culture, nerd culture becomes part of the more mainstream, you know, with all these movies that are making billions of dollars, it's sort of like these people that had been, you know, were getting wedgies when they were kids now have the sense of power or they're feeling empowered. And so they're almost being bullies in their own way. And the thing is like, you know, some of these things that are being said to women, especially is abhorrent to me, and I'm bad. I've said some bad stuff, you know. I've had to go on record and apologize, but it's like if I look at something and go, wow, that's really sexist or that's really misogynistic, like then we've got a problem. Like if I'm noticing it, we've got a problem, because I tend to be clueless about stuff like that.
All right. Anybody else want to weigh in on anything else on this, or can we move on to another subject?
Let's move on.
Chris is, all right,
let's
Chris
move
is
on.
So
now
we got some stuff to get to, man.
I know we do. And we've already gone a long time, so we want to get, but we can't not touch on these things.
Yeah,
but I just want to say this. I mean, like I say, it's important to us with what we're doing. I think Brett mentioned to you what it is, and we're not ready quite to reveal it because it's so far away, but you know, that we do include the diversity and everything. So we're going to be studying it, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us a little bit more about it if it is something you're going to look into too. So in history of the industry. So Chris, do you want to go Albert Payun? Are we pronouncing his name correctly?
I've heard it pronounced both ways. I believe the proper pronunciation is Payun.
Payun.
Okay. I do believe.
Okay. Albert Payun.
Okay,
Chris, you want to talk? Yeah, so Albert Payun or Black Exploitation. Where are you going, Chris?
We are going long, so I will just ask you about Brain Smasher and if you have any stories, because I know you were just a PA early in your career. But I imagine the sets of this man's films must be absolutely insane.
They were pretty, this was a pretty insane movie. This was, at the time, that was the biggest movie I'd ever worked on. It was shot here in Portland. And I was both an office PA and on-set PA. And because I was so trusted, I got to actually spend a lot of time both with Albert and with, I didn't spend that much time with the Dice Man, with Andrew Dice Clay, although I did spend some time around him. But the great part was I got to spend a ton of time around Tim Thomerson, a little bit of time around Charlie Rocket, Brian, oh God, what's, is it Brian okay, James?
Is there any explanation then why the cops in the film are from the 50s?
No, there's no explanation.
They're wearing hats. Okay, no, just, yeah. Just one of the bizarre things that happens in these films that I need to know about.
It was just a really down and dirty quick shoot. And Albert used on that movie, it was a multi-camera shoot, so a lot of stuff was one or two takes, but there was two or three cameras rolling through a lot of it, and so it was just really interesting to watch him work, because he knew what he wanted, and he got it. You know, he got it really quick, down and dirty, and it was, you know, super ultra low budget film, and to me it was just like this eye-opening experience, because up until that point I just worked on like mostly commercials and PSAs and things like that. And I just happened to luck out. And I was, at one point they were talking about hiring me on to do his next film, which I think was Nemesis with Olivier Gruner or whatever that guy's name is. And the whole thing fell
apart. I think he's wet.
No. Actually, I really don't like that film. I love.
But you Nemesis love it in a way that you don't like it. You love it even though you don't like it, because you love the guys. You just.
No. Yeah, but he was an interesting guy to work with. At the time, he was very. And again, this was, you know, almost over 20 years ago, so I don't know what he's like now. But he didn't talk a lot, and he was very much into, like, he would just sort of whisper into someone's ear what he would want, and it was usually like some assistant or something like that, or the director of photography would sort of whisper into their ear what he wanted, and then that person would have to convey that to the actors.
To me, that explains a lot about his movies.
and I was fortunate enough that I got to be I got to do that one day on set. So he explained to me everything he wanted. I had to explain it to other people. And then over the walkie talkie, I was the one who called action and called cut. And it was weird.
That is weird.
Now,
so awesome.
Did anyone actually find the running joke through the movie about Chinese ninjas funny at the time? I mean, I love the movie. I think it has a great pace. I think it's very funny in bits, but every scene has this weird, they're ninjas. No, they're Chinese. They can't be ninjas joke. Every time.
Yeah. No, I don't think anybody, I think they all thought they were making Citizen Kane, to be honest. You know, with the exception of maybe Tim Thomerson. Tim Thomerson, I think, was the only one who really knew what was going on. And he was there. He told me he was there because he owed a lot in alimony or something along those lines. So, but yeah, it was definitely an interesting experience. You know,
what was the budget on this sucker? Any idea?
I want to say it was like, it was about $1 million. It was probably one, maybe a little under $2 million, but it wouldn't have been much more than that.
Go ahead.
But yeah, I wonder if I still have a copy of the budget somewhere. I doubt it.
And was the movie we're talking about has probably the worst title of all time. Yeah. Was that the shooting title? From a marketing standpoint, there is no way to sell Brain Smasher, a Love Story.
Well, when it was shot, when they were shooting it, the working title was Sam and Ed. Whoa. And which was, that's even actually worse than Brain Smasher. Yeah. And the reason they used that title was because nobody wanted to be like, no one wanted to do location agreements with a movie called Brain Smasher. And I know there's another title that's like The Supermodel and the Boxer or something like that. Or no, The Supermodel and the Bouncer. So, like, I think in terms of titles, this movie was doomed from the very beginning.
You know what got me about this movie? The thing that I never understood, this is like 92, 93 in that range, right? In height of, you know, Dice Mania and everything. And he's Andrew Dice Clay, right? He's the Dice Man. Yeah. PG-13.
What? He was really trying to, my understanding at the time was he was really trying to tone his persona down and trying to get, you know, a little bit more, I guess you could say, user friendly.
But that's not what made him the money. So why?
Exactly. I know.
Well, but isn't that why he went completely away from the persona for a while and now he's come back to the persona?
Exactly. Yeah. How well did that work for him?
Yeah. You know? Yeah, it didn't work out that well at all. I will say this, though. He seemed like one of the saddest people I've ever met. He had an entourage. You could have made a movie about his entourage. But he would just sort of stand there in the corner, and he just had
this sadness. He was in Entourage. He was in the show.
Oh, was he? I never watched Entourage.
Yeah.
But he just had – he just looked like a very sad, you know, just – yeah. He didn't look – he never looked very happy. I couldn't tell if he wasn't happy being in the movie or if he just wasn't happy with his life.
Little of A, little of B.
Yeah.
Well, this was after our adventure. What was it, Adventures of Ford Fairlane?
He was at rock bottom at this point in his career.
Yeah.
I love Ford Fairlane. Okay, now
it was rated R. It was good.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now I more have to make a comment about. Now you did a documentary on blaxploitation, and I just want to say how freaking cool you are for managing to hook up interviews with Ron O'Neill and William Marshall and, you know, and Jim Kelly and Fred Williamson and Jim Brown, I mean, and all the other people, because that's amazing how cool that is.
Yeah, thank you. That's I'm actually working on a book right now that's a history of blaxploitation. That's a pretty in-depth history, and there's a whole section of it that chronicles, it's a little unorthodox to do it in a book like this, but I'm probably gonna do it anyway, that chronicles like my whole experience making that documentary and you know, the relationships that I built with some of those people. Some of them actually became friends, and you know, we continued on that relationship for years, Ron O'Neill being one of them before he passed away. And so, yeah, it was a very crucial time in my life. And so I'm trying to figure out how to work that into this sort of historical narrative of those films. And it's a much bigger historical piece than any other book that's ever been written on the subject. Not that there's a ton of books
on
the subject.
Was it?
No, I've gone looking for them. They're few and far between and mostly horrible.
Yes.
Was it 2004 that this documentary came out? And it's available now on YouTube where we watched it. You placed it up there. Was it 2004? Is that the right year?
That's when it was finally finished. But I actually started it in 96.
96.
Wow. I spent 95, 96. I started shooting it, started editing, and it was still shooting in 97. Ran out of money, life kind of happened, I took a break from it, and then around 2001 I started editing it again, and finished it up right around 2003, 2004.
Well, that does partially answer my next question, though I'm going to ask it regardless.
Okay.
Because I think the elephant in the room, and I won't say what color that elephant is, but the elephant in the room is does Tim Reed ever, does he ever age?
I don't think he does, you know?
It's freaky.
I know.
I don't know what he's doing right now. I haven't I should go on IMDb to see what he's been up to recently, because his interview was brilliant. There's only part of it. There's only bits and pieces of
it. That brings up another question Brett and I had.
And that is?
How many hours worth of footage do you have? Because this doc comes in a little less than 90 minutes, correct?
Yeah.
So how many hours worth of footage, and can we get it all?
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it's not like there's hundreds of hours of footage. There's somewhere between probably 25 to 40 hours of footage somewhere in there. Because I never conducted – the longest interview I ever conducted was with Ron O'Neill, and that one clocked in at just about an hour. Because I knew going in, I didn't want to be one of those guys that had so much footage he didn't know what to do with. And recently I started taking the actual interviews I've only posted the Jim Kelly and the Ron O'Neill interviews on YouTube in their entirety. They're broken up into chunks, but I'm going to do that with probably most of them, at least the ones with people that you've heard of. So the Tim Reed one will go up at some point. The Glenn Turman one will go up at some point. It's just finding the time to sort of digitize them and chop them up and post them.
Jim Kelly really, really impressed me in this. And I think everybody did. It's just, there was so much introspection and great, just the perspective that they had and thoughtfulness towards the subject matter by all these people you interviewed. I mean, it's just so well spoken, but he was one that really impressed me. I'm like, wow, this guy's fascinating and so smart.
Yeah, it was a really, for me, and that's part of the reason why in this book that I'm working on, I want there to be an autobiographical component, because it really did, it changed my life in a lot of ways, because, you know, not only did I interview everybody, but, you know, I actually spent time, you know, setting up the pre-interviews, talking to people, and then in some cases, you know, getting to know them afterwards. And in a lot of ways, it became like this, you know, this intense, like, life study of sorts. You know, it was almost like going to a university for a time and just being mentored by all of these incredibly, you know, some of them were really incredibly brilliant people. And Jim just had some really interesting stuff. He was a very humble guy. And, you know, I didn't see him again. I ran into him about 4 years ago down at San Diego Comic-Con. And that was the first time I'd seen him since I'd interviewed him. And, you know, we had a great conversation. We were talking, and I was doing an event, a film event here in Portland. I wanted to bring him up here and then he passed away. It was really, it was very sudden, or it seemed very sudden. Although I'd heard from a couple people that he was very ill, like maybe 6 months before he actually died. But it was, for me, that was devastating, because Jim Kelly is my childhood hero more than any of those other people I interviewed. He's the one. And so losing him was just devastating for me.
You know, and I didn't even know he had passed. And I guess, I don't know, the news cycle didn't cover it much, I suppose, but I didn't realize that. How long ago was that?
It was last summer. It was like, it hasn't even been I don't think it's been a year yet, or it's coming up on it. It might have been a year, like June or July. It was right around this time, because I had been down in WonderCon in April of last year, and he was there, and I didn't run into him. And I was like, oh, I'll see him at Comic-Con in July, because I wanted to talk to him about doing this big film event. And he had passed away before Comic-Con, so it was somewhere in like May or June or something like that.
Well, Chris, X or blaxploitation questions, you gotta have a bunch.
I mean very rarely do I get to talk to anybody who's seen more blaxploitation films than me. I love Superfly. We sort of touched on it, but other Gordon Parks Jr.'s films are almost unwatchable.
Yeah.
Why is that?
It's
what happens?
Well, Superfly was lightning in a bottle more than anything. I think it was just the right time, the right place. And you can't dismiss Curtis Mayfield's music.
Never. Wow.
You can't dismiss Carl Lee as Eddie. There's a whole bunch of things. I mean, from a technical standpoint, Superfly is kind of a mess of a film. It's not like, you know, the most technically proficient. They just got it right. But yeah,
like all this Superfly TNT, it's more technically proficient, but it's not a good movie.
Yeah, it's not a good movie. And I think that, you know, when you look at the story of Superfly, you know, everyone comes down on it and they, oh, it's, you know, it's glamorizing drugs or whatever, but it's like, it's really a perfect story. Like if you study the, you know, whatever, you could look at Joseph Campbell's, you know, Hero Has a Thousand Faces, all that sort of stuff. And Superfly follows that model so well. It's this epic journey that this guy goes on. And it's really about this, you know, a guy seeking redemption for all these things that he did. And his name is Priest, and he's seeking redemption for his past crimes. He's trying to get out of that life of crime. That story is so compelling. And the fact that he is able to get out of the life of crime and escape using his wits more than anything else is a huge part of it. And then it's Ron O'Neill. Ron O'Neill is just such an amazing actor that sells it in and of itself. That sells the movie.
Yeah, he's fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. I mean, I like yes, Superfly, I loved. And I loved him in the documentary as well. I mean, just so incredibly well-spoken.
Yeah, he was great. I think the YouTube, his interview is chopped up, I think, into four parts because his was the longest, and it's pretty intense. You get a good feeling for what he was like as a, you know, where he was at that point in his life, which was, he was a pretty cynical guy, but his is the most informative of all the interviews, especially from a historical context.
So then I'd really like to touch on, because you have Superfly, which is this amazing blaxploitation movie, and then you go over to Rudy Ray Moore, who is by himself very cool, you know, and the Dolomite character, and the way those all the different films were made by him, and it's such a different feel.
Yeah,
you know, like can you speak on that different feel, and like how much, really, how much ground blaxploitation wound up covering in such a small time?
It was just all over the place. Rudy was an interesting guy because he was a little bit older than everybody else. A lot of people don't realize that. Like, I couldn't tell you for sure, but like when Dolomite came out, I think Rudy might have already been in he was well into his 40s at that point. So he had a few years on a lot of people, because guys like Ron O'Neill were in their 30s, early 30s when they were making these movies. So in a lot of ways, Rudy was a byproduct of an even earlier time. And so his films are very much, there's a thing here in the U.S. called the Chitlin Circuit. And the Chitlin Circuit was where a lot of black performers performed down south. It was very vaudeville-based, a lot of music, a lot of comedy. And Rudy was part of that Chitlin Circuit. And there was, in the 30s and 40s here in the U.S., there was what was called race movies or black caste movies that were also reflective of that. And when you watch Dolomite, those are just sort of like R-rated versions of those movies from the 30s and 40s. They're R-rated versions of, you know, and updated versions of the Chitlin Circuit. And so in that regard, a lot of people don't get that. But from a historical standpoint, he's this really important missing link historically. And you know, if you ever talk to him about it, you know, when he was alive, you talk to him about it, he was always really open about it. The problem was that most people never saw that connection because, you know, no one had watched any of these movies from the 30s and 40s before. So they weren't able to see the correlation. But then in terms of blaxploitation in the bigger picture, yeah, it was all over the place because there was comedy and there was, you know, there was horror films and there was romance. And so to call blaxploitation a genre is, is sort of misplaced, because at least within the genre, there was certainly subgenres, you know?
Chris, you had something?
When you mentioned the Chitlin circuit, do you know if that's where Mama May came from? She has one film. I'm blanking on the title.
Oh, right, Moms Mabley. Moms Mabley.
Oh, Moms Mabley.
Yeah, she did a movie called Amazing Grace in the 70s. But yeah, she was
Is an amazing film. I laughed so hard at that film. But I couldn't find any other film she was ever in.
She did some TV stuff. She would have been on shows like Laughing and things like that. And Red Fox was part of the Chitlin circuit. And you know, a lot of those other comedians were. They were all part of it. That's where they all honed their skills and they recorded party albums and Rudy was he was an interesting guy. He was someone that I was lucky enough to spend time with, you know, on and off over the years after the documentary. And I last time I saw him was probably about a year before he passed away. And,
could you make it through his last film, the one with his sons?
Was it The Return of Dolomite or whatever?
Yes, The Return of Dolomite. I tried.
There was technically, I believe there was two Return of Dolomite movies.
I've seen both of them,
and both of them were pretty bad. He was pretty long in the tooth towards the end. So
it's still trying the karate. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was one of my favorite parts of watching Rudy Ray Moore movies was his karate.
Yes.
It was like butt chops, you know?
Yeah, absolutely hilarious.
So I do want to know, like, I mean, you've seen so much. Like, we all know about the Superflies, the Shafts, and stuff like that. So what are some of the best, most important movies to come out as blaxploitation that you would recommend that maybe people don't know about as much?
Well, I think hands down, I used to not say this, but it's grown on me over the years. I think Across 110th Street is probably the best, if not the best.
You include that in the genre. Usually most academics don't, because it comes out a year before either Shaft or Sweet Sweetback had a song.
Yeah, no, I include it, you know, and it has all the trappings. So I would say Across 110th Street for sure. I mean, that's a great film. I absolutely love it. And there's another one. Oh, Gordon's War, which I was recently rewatching with Paul Winfield. Ossie Davis directed it. I think that is that's like a gem. That is a true gem that most people don't know about or haven't seen. I think it was released on DVD a few years ago as part of a double feature disc.
It was a double feature on a Shout Factory disc. An excellent, yes. a nice conversion. It was really restored well.
Yeah, and I think that's a great movie. I think Trouble Man is solid. It's not the best, but it's the interesting thing about Trouble Man is that it's more like the Shaft books than the Shaft movies were.
That similar, that's for sure.
Yeah. The Spook Who Sat by the Door, one of my all-time favorites. And that was based on a novel by Sam Greenlee, who just passed away like maybe 2 months ago. So there's some out there, but you know, the thing is it's like with any other sort of exploitation genre, like spaghetti westerns or kung fu movies. You know, there's like over 600 spaghetti westerns, but you really only need to watch like 10, you know, and you've seen the best there is to offer.
Only get 10, you're not going to get to the Cooley High, which is an amazing film.
Yeah, no, Cooley High. Okay, so I'll say 20. How's that? Okay. If you do 20, you'll definitely get to Cooley High.
It's funny because, like, I mean, I love the best of the genre, but I also have to say that I do have a soft spot for the worst of the genre as well. And, you know, because what, like watching Human Tornado and stuff like that, but Avenging Disco Godfather, I mean, I love Rudy Ray Moore.
You know, those aren't even the worst, man.
No.
Fred Williamson in an Italy He made some horrible, horrible films.
But, you know, like...
Blackenstein? If you watch Blackenstein, you've seen the worst. So.
You know, because there's this part of me that's so very proud of having a VHS copy of Black Gestapo. And it's just one of those cases where I'm like, I know I shouldn't be proud of this, but I kind of am.
I still have my VHS of it as well, so... You're either in good company or bad company, depending on how you want to look at it.
Yeah, it's just... See, I mean, for me, like, I could watch most of these movies over and over again way sooner than I would choose to watch any Hollywood movie that's coming out right now.
Yeah.
My turn, guys. My turn. All right.
We're geeking out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a couple of things that I want to touch upon, and obviously we could do an entire podcast series on blaxploitation films.
Good idea.
So, I mean, we're just yeah, I know. We're just here quickly on it. But one of the things is that, I mean, Brett and I were in high school. I think we're probably 15, 16 years old when, you know, we're listening to Eazy-E and NWA and everything. We go down to the video store and we see these movies. We're not familiar with the characters at the time. And we pick them up and we get them just because the cool factor eked out of the VHS copies, even then, even though the black culture that we were being exposed to at the time was very different, the influence was still so strong.
Yeah, no, that's very true, and you know, there's a connection between, you know, blaxploitation and hip hop, and especially like the gangster rap of NWA, Eazy-E, Snoop Dogg, all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the historical stuff that I find fascinating that I'm trying to collect and put into this big giant book that I'm going to at some point finish writing and put out there.
One of the films that I let's go from this first. One of the things about these blaxploitation films was they were ripe for parody, which we saw afterwards. So yeah. I just want to get your opinion on some of the parodies you saw on, you know, I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker, and even the In Living Color television show and other shows like that.
Black Dynamite.
Yeah, Black Dynamite, which is pretty cool. Yeah.
You know, I don't mind the parodies and I don't mind the satires. They're fine. They're fun. I laugh at them when I watch them. I guess, you know, for me, the biggest problem is that, like, I would just like to see some badass characters, you know, mm-hmm. like I'd love to see Idris Elba in like a really great action flick where he's the lead, you know, like the show he's on for BBC, Luther, is an amazing show.
Incredible. Just boom. Wow. Head blown.
You know, but it's like they're still letting Shia LaBeouf make movies where he's the lead and Idris Elba's not catching a break that way. And so that bothers me. And, you know, it's not to say that, I mean, like when The Equalizer comes out with Denzel Washington later this year, like we should make no mistake about it. That's a blaxploitation movie. I mean, Denzel Washington in American Gangster is a really expensive blaxploitation movie. And so I would like to see, you know, I don't mind seeing the Black Dynamites and all that sort of stuff, but I would like to see some, you know, some really good straightforward action movies, you know, or some superhero movies or something that where the characters aren't treated as jokes and they're not comedies. And, you know, it's the same thing like with comics, you know, I like the Black Dynamite comic, but I would love to see something that wasn't comedic, you know?
I'd just to say Idris Elba for James Bond. That's what I want.
I'd love that. Or Idris Elba in a movie that gives him his own franchise outside of the Bond movie.
Yeah.
Because, you know, because, like, that's the thing. Like, I'd love to see him as Bond, but you know and I know that people are going to complain. You can't have him be James Bond, you know, blah, 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 you know?
I'll fight to the death for that one. Like, he's my next choice, no matter what. Like, he'll be way better than Daniel Craig, but okay.
We're citing Black Dynamite as an example of what we don't want to see, although we like what it is.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're dismissing films like Bone, Blood and Bone.
Blood and Bone was great. I love that movie.
Yeah, no, it's, yeah. It's, but Michael J. White has a ton of action films.
Yep.
I just wanted to point that out because Black Dynamite is just one of his action films. It's not a total desert what I'm saying out there. Of course, I strike low in most. I like the low budget films. So,
you know, and I'd love to see Michael J. White in something. You know, it doesn't have to be $100 million movie, but I'd like to think that he could carry a $20 or $30 million movie. You know, like
without a Spawn costume.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? He got the shot and the Spawn costume. It failed, and he's never been given the shot again, even though, I mean, he's been rumored for lots of big things, but he's never ended up getting them, and it's a damn shame.
Yeah, you know, I mean, anything that Mark Wahlberg is in, like, you could put Michael Jai White in. You know what I'm saying? I mean, like, just put Michael Jai White in whatever part that, you know, whenever they try to turn Mark Wahlberg into an action hero or, yeah, and that's just it. There's... Or better yet, you know, like, I mean, they what was that damn movie, the Alex Cross movie?
Oh, with Tyler Perry?
With Tyler Perry. Oh. Like,
can
really?
Can we get rid of him, though? I know we need more blacks, but I really hate his films.
But, like, you couldn't have, like, Idris Elba or Michael Jai White, either of those guys would have done, like, they could have slept walk through that movie and would have been better than Tyler Perry was. And so that's what I'd like to see more of that. And you know, if I had I had some dream projects and some people were to throw some money my way, that's the sort of stuff that I'd like to try to do, you know, is like, you know, a Born Identity sort of movie, only like Idris Elba could have been in Born Identity. You know, there's no reason why he couldn't have been in that.
Now is Tyler Perry or his films the new black exploitation? I mean, I mean, they don't appeal to any of us.
Yeah,
him and Ice Cube. Let's call that the new marginalization.
Yeah, no, I mean Tyler Perry's movies are they're very. I say that they're part of the Chitlin Circuit mentality for sure, and so yeah, they definitely cater to a very specific audience and they make their money. And technically speaking, that's what exploitation in film is. And so, yeah, they're it. They're, you know, he's very independent. You know, he finances his stuff himself and he's got a nice little distribution deal with Lionsgate, but he's pretty self-contained. He's easily the smartest, if not the smartest, one of the smartest people working in American film right now. Now, the fact that he's not running a bigger studio is, I'm not sure what that says. If it says how racist Hollywood is, that he hasn't been tapped to do it, or the fact that, you know, it's his overall lack of talent. But there's guys running other studios that are far less talented than Tyler Perry, not nearly as smart as he is from a business standpoint, but yet they're running, you know, whatever, whether it's like a New Line or whatever. I don't even think New Line's in business anymore, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
All right. I have one last question.
Sure.
We were talking about this and then, I have 100 million questions, but we haven't talked about the presentation of African-Americans in history and, you know, the offensive covers that you would see in the presentation, the huge lips and everything like that back, you know, Captain Marvel and things like that back in the day. And we haven't talked about Milestone and these different things. I mean, it's just a billion things comics related, nevertheless, everything else that we didn't cover. But the film that I actually want to get your opinion on is, I don't know if this counts as blaxploitation. I consider it that. It's done by a white director. It's got animation. I saw it as Street Fight. The title, though, it's most commonly known by as Coonskin.
Coonskin. Oh, yeah.
And I just want to say, not knowing anything about it at the time, I watched it. I didn't know who the director was. I didn't know his color. And I was offended by it. Is that correct? Because I saw it probably when I was in high school. Like, I don't know what to think of this film. And I haven't watched it since because at the time it turned me off so much. And yet it seems to be fairly well thought of.
Everybody has that problem with that movie. It's like, what am I supposed to think of this? It pushes the envelope in ways that no other film or very few films ever do. And I love that movie. Like, I think it's great. But I can see why I can see why so many people are offended by it. It's one of those movies where it's like you shouldn't watch it in mixed company because, you know, with people who are easily offended or whatever. But I think that there's some brilliant stuff in that film. And
so what am I missing? What was I missing when I saw it? That,
well, it might have just been your age that you were at. That, you know, the you said you saw it when you were younger, right?
Yeah, I was in high school. Yeah.
Yeah, because the first time I tried watching it, I was like, "What the heck?" But it is offensive. You know, I mean, that's the thing. He's just very in your face about it. And that's of all of his films, more than Heavy Traffic or Fritz the Cat or Hey Good Lookin', this is his most in your face. And he's in your face about, you know, race and about sex and about, you know, police brutality. And it's, you know, and the fact that it's animated is like, you're not supposed to feel this uncomfortable watching a cartoon, you know?
Yeah.
Which is why I like it.
Well, it's animation and live action is the thing.
Yeah, the combination of the two. I like it. And, you know, it's I've got a friend who wants to do a comic book project, you know, collaborate on something with me. And I was like, when he was describing what he wanted to do, I was like, oh, that sounds kind of like Coonskin. Like, we need to watch this movie. If we're going to go move forward with this project, let's watch Coonskin to see what they do. And not necessarily try to replicate it, but just to learn from it, to see, you know, what they do right, what they do wrong. But I do I think it's so it's just a very confrontational movie. And I think that he thought because he was making an animated movie, he could get away with being so confrontational. But it still rubs a lot of people the wrong way.
And I was offended enough watching it, not knowing who the director was. When I found out he was a white guy, I was far more offended. And is that an issue? Like, would those people who are offended by it, do you think they would consider it okay if it had been made by an African American?
Oh, I don't think so. I think that I think like it might have been like half a degree more acceptable. But you know, in a lot of ways, it's almost like his response to Disney's Song of the South, which is arguably one of the most racially offensive movies of all time. Mm-hmm. And it was almost like he was trying to do his version of Song of the South, but have it, rather than have it be a feel good movie, he was like, I'm going to have it be as violent as humanly possible and as confrontational as humanly possible. And so, yeah, I don't know. After we're done with the show, I might go pop it in and watch it tonight. And
I mean, I'm unfortunately got to get up early in the morning. Otherwise, I just found the entire 83 minutes and 21 seconds on YouTube.
Yeah, there you go.
And so I think before you come back, and I really hope you'll be willing to, I'll watch it and we'll get into it a little more.
Yeah, no, most definitely. I would love to come back. There's going to be some, hopefully in the next few months, there's going to be some pretty big announcements on some projects that I'll then be able to talk about, that a lot of it's right in league with what we're talking about now.
So we want you on to promote. Absolutely. We also want you on because you're having fun.
Yeah, so no, it's great. This is very fun.
I hope so. I think, I don't know if you've done a podcast with from Canada before. It probably does have, because culturally there's a lot of similarities, but there's a lot of differences too. So, you know, I hope we had some perspectives that you enjoyed and were unique to you. So that, you know, that would make me feel good if that would happen on this show.
Yeah, no, it was really good. And I haven't been up to Canada in nearly 20 years.
Wow.
And at some point need to get back up there.
Well, the Calgary Convention, of course, here is now, I think, the fourth largest convention in the world. And the thing is, if you come and visit us, number one, we'll get together with a bunch of creators and you'll come with us and we'll go for poutine. I don't know if you know what that is, but it's fries, cheese, curds, and gravy, and it's delicious, and Canadian beer, which is superior. I'll give us that. We may not have much, but we got the Canadian beer, and we would love to. And you can stay with Brett for free.
There you go.
Oh, Brett, thank you for offering.
Hey, hey, no problem. happy to be of assistance.
but no, we'd love it if you get up here. The thing about the Calgary Convention is not only is there a large amount of attendees, so big that way, but it's a city with money.
Yeah.
So sales are good. And the economy here is extremely strong, and people come in and they buy. And at that convention, they are willing to buy and expecting to buy books that they wouldn't try otherwise. And that's one of the refreshing things about it.
Well, that's good. I will definitely put it on my calendar of shows to get up for or get to over for or however it works. If with you guys, it's up and over. So
there you go.
That's right. That's right. That's cool. Right. Hey, if it's good enough for Greg Rucka.
Yeah.
That's right. We've had Portlanders before Portlandish folk.
Portlandish. How is Portlandy? Is that at all accurate? What the hell?
Oh God, that's a topic for another conversation.
it's about the same thing we got from Greg.
All right, we're just gonna say it out there. We're brand new Twitter account. Of course, we all have individual Twitter accounts as well, but brand new Twitter account that doesn't have many followers yet because it's so new. It's just a couple weeks old. We'll try and get you on there, and that's at wetalkpodcast.com. Pretty simple.
Just at wetalkpodcast, actually. Just don't.
Actually, my mistake. At wetalkpodcast, and you can email us about comic book shows if you care to. I'm sorry, now I'm losing
it. Comics at WeTalkPodcast.com.
Comics, yes, getting
there's,
late for me.
There's the WeTalkPodcast.com.
There. Comics at WeTalkPodcast.com. And of course, we're on iTunes, we're on Stitcher, we're on TuneIn Radio. We're always on Comicosity. This week we got put up on Bleeding Cool, so I mean, we'll try and do that again if we could. But, we're all over the place. You can find us all over the place. But thank you very much. That's our plugs. And like I say, we'll go OUT on this one. But we're going to give you the chance to the We Talk Comics tradition. The guest always gets to leave with what we like to call plug your shit.
Plug my shit. Just head over to badassmofo.com. That's spelled badassmofo.com. And if you can't remember that, then just go to the davidwalkersite.com, all one word. And that just is a gateway to everything over there. So, and that's the plugging and buy stuff once you get there.
There you go. That's right. David Walker, you've been an amazing guest. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Awesome.